Good afternoon, brethren. I really although speechless and breathless, the two special music was just wonderful. And I feel it will be a form of cheating on my part if I wouldn't ask, if I can't ask, if it's possible to have that taped, or if you record it and I can have a copy. Because it would be a shame to just let that go and not share it with people at home. Really, I feel so. So in case, if it's possible, if there's a tape, I really would not mind having it. It amazes me sometimes the talents that God has blessed us with in the church. And I think we don't harness them enough. And listening to this two wonderful special music has confirmed to me that it's something needs to be done to harness all the special music and the individual talents in singing and music that people have displayed over the years. Possibly, if they could be just be compiled together, I'm sure many people, at least I know from my end, we do love music. And we buy music that are Bible-based, scriptural-based, what we call gospel songs. It will be great to get some that really the meaning of the wordings can be so moving. So I want to thank you. And you, sir, for that wonderful music. It's really amazing. Shabbat Shalom. I just can't help saying that. It's been a pleasure to come back. And I want to say that I'm really grateful. Everybody, I'm looking at you here. You look exactly like people I've met and I've seen and I've known for years. Some of you, I remember from 2 years ago. Last year, my wife and I were really looking forward to seeing all of you. I was looking at this bulletin, and the faces, the names there, I can easily attach faces to the names this time. I can see Tina Carson here, and I can see Daniel. I saw Daniel some time ago. Okay, so people don't look so difficult. I mean, so strange, and I can see him here as well, and everyone here looks so welcoming, and I can see all the smiles, reducing my nervousness. Okay. My wife and my kids and the people in my house, my sister-in-law, some of the members who stay with me, and the people who are at church, were 7 hours ahead of you. I spoke with them about the time they finished church, just about the time we were leaving for our first service this morning. And they say, I shall convey their greetings and their regards to you. My wife was so eager to talk to or see you people that she was wondering if I could connect and have her say hello in person on Hangout or Skype. And I said, you know, we will pray and strive. Make sure we come at a time when we could be here for a Sabbath and you can get to meet everyone. Because last year when we both came together, we weren't privileged to stay for service, so we could meet all of you. And for that, we really apologize. I've been here in the U.S. since Monday. I came for two conferences that has to do with my job in the IT. And I've been with Mr. Keller. He's been a wonderful dad. My dad is not in the church, but God has blessed me with so many people that I can proudly, honestly say they are like my own parents. And I've been blessed with so many people I can call my moms, people I refer to as my grannies. I have many brothers and sisters. One of my sisters that I really am fond of, and I was looking forward to seeing, is Tina down there. We spent some time chatting and discussing, and I'm just seeing her in the flesh for the first time, really. But it feels like I've known her for decades. And so it's a blessing and a pleasure for us all in Nigeria to know we have families who really think about us, who pray about us. And I can remember this gentleman here. My memories are not as it used to be. It's because I've lost most of the hair on my head, the sun in Nigeria. Okay, the people in the Republic of Benin also, because I told them I was going to be here and I was going to see Mr. Mikkelsen, who I work with, and Mr. Kellers, they send their greetings. They also say they feel like a family that they have not met. The people in Ghana who have seen Mr. and Mrs. Kellers also send their regards. And everyone wants me to just convey their greetings to you. I've received several texts since morning asking that I should say hello to all of you and to wish you a wonderful Sabbath. I will be leaving here on Wednesday, going to Spokane. On Tuesday, I have a seminar or workshop in Charlotte. And then from there, I'll be going to Spokane, and from there, going back home on the 21st. And it's been nice to be here. I just wish it were possible for me to be here with my wife. She just couldn't take the time out at this period. Because we planned last year our leave time for the feast, youth camp, our challenger program in December, as well as we have planning a week, the family, 1 week, all of us together, all five of us will take a trip and for the first time do something together outside the shores of Nigeria. And we're looking forward to that. When I was told that I was going to speak here, I knew I was going to speak anyway, if I were going to be here. I kept wondering and thinking of what I would share with you. I figured I should sit down and listen to people talks. But I knew I was going to be required to speak. And what I did was, I kept thinking, up to 2 days ago, what I was going to talk about. And finally, I just said, okay, let me just share with you a message that I gave in Lagos 2 weeks ago. And several events happened in the week that made me use that message. On my phone, I have about 1,800 names and numbers that I send SMS to. On Friday evenings, about 6:35 to 6:40, I program it, a bulk SMS online, and also on Sabbath morning by 5 a.m. The SMS just to share a scripture or an encouragement word, an encouraging word for the brethren for the past week and for the week to come. And I found over the years, I've been doing that for like 5 years now, and any week I choose not to, I just don't send it. I keep getting people calling me or sending me SMS. Mr. Kimball, we didn't get your message today. Mr. Kimball, we didn't get your message today. And so, even when I'm out of town, I program it and schedule it so that it's sent. So, of the 1,800 people, about 140 are members of the church that I know, in the three congregations we have in Nigeria. And I include people in Cameroon, in Ghana, in the Republic of Benin, and in Togo as well. Some of them will send me emails, some of them will send me SMS back. The remaining, almost about maybe 1,200, 1,300 out of that, they're just good news subscribers. Maybe good news subscribers, people who have sent in an SMS or have called me or have sent an email at one time or the other, and they've called it more than once, and I've asked if I could put them on my SMS list, and they have said yes. So there are people on that list that I've known for 3-4 years. I've spoken to them. I've met some of them. Some we've spoken on Skype. We've used Hangout to talk. I've counseled them on various things they've discussed. And a lot of them often consider themselves as members of the church. About half of that number live in areas where we do not have congregations. And so they consider themselves members of the church. There are even some who actually send in their tithes on a regular basis. So one of them, called Emmanuel, that I've been in contact with for a year, about a year and a few weeks now, called me a month ago. And he told me he's having some problem with his dad. He was born into a Muslim family, grew up and was living and attending university in the upper northern part of Nigeria, Maiduguri, far north, predominantly Muslim. His mom became a Muslim when he was about 4 years old, and his dad kicked her out of the house. As is typical back home, when things like that happen, the kids stay with the dad because he could take care of the family, the children. He entered university and discovered Christianity, in quote, and also getting in touch with his mom. But he didn't join the mom's Catholic church. He stumbled. He said he really wanted to find out if he's going to be a Christian. He wants to be sure he's doing what is right. And so going on the internet, he came across various websites, and somehow God led him to the United Church of God. And so he emailed me and asked for some materials, which I sent to him. And so we've been in contact, asking questions, discussing various things, about a year plus now. And so a month ago, he sent me an email that he's having a problem with his dad, and he needs my prayers. And we talked about it. The dad wasn't very happy that he's now a Christian. He's not so happy that he's trying to go the same way the mom went. And then 2 weeks before my, about 3 weeks ago, he called me on phone that he really needs to talk to me or to talk to someone, that things are really desperate and he's really contemplating suicide. That kind of threw me. I was a little bit shocked. First time, we used to joke that you probably, there are very few people in Africa or in Nigeria who will commit suicide. It has to be an extreme case. Now, things are pretty tough generally for most people. And if you've coped with a lot of stress from growing up, you kind of get used to it. You develop a kind of a thick skin to trouble and stress. And so it has to be really extreme cases for someone to say they will commit suicide. So I said, look, are you on campus? He said, yes. Can you get to a cyber cafe? Maybe this is something I would like to look at you and talk. Can you go and hang out or Skype so we could talk about this? And he said, okay. And about half an hour, he was on hangout. Okay, I didn't set my time. Sorry. So on the hangout, I looked at Emmanuel. He was looking really distraught. By the way, I hope what I'm saying is clear. I have to try and speak a little differently. At home, I will speak like this. I have to try and speak a little different so that everything that I am saying is clear to all of you. Now, that's a little different from what I'm saying. Here, I have to speak a little bit by rolling my tongue, and that means sometimes I go back home, I'm sore on my tongue because I've beaten a few times. I'm trying to speak like the American, so it seems you guys roll your tongue a little bit when you speak. You don't pronounce all the words. Like you say words, and I say word at home. So I hope you'll understand what I'm saying. I said understand. I don't say understand. So we were talking anyway, and I said, Emmanuel, what's the problem? You cannot commit suicide. God said, thou shalt not kill. Your life is not your life. You cannot take your life. That will be committing suicide. It's like breaking the commandment that says you shall not kill. What is the problem? And then he told me. He said, I just don't understand what is happening. I'm confused. I experienced so much joy as I was reading the Bible and discovering God's truth and getting a lot of encouragement and positive news about what is happening in the world, about what's going to happen in the world and the plan of God for my mom, for my dad, for my brothers and sisters, and for all the millions of people whom God is not calling now. And I can relate to that. I can relate to that. And he said, but things are not working as they're supposed to work. When I talk to my friends who are Christians in school, and I try to let them understand that they are not doing what the Bible says. They are zealous. They want to serve God. But they're following traditions that their fathers have passed down to them. And I try to explain to them about the Sabbath. Try to explain to them the truth about Easter and Christmas. And that they should try to lead by every word that comes out of the mouth of God. I don't get a positive response. They just ridicule me. Many good friends have looked at me and figured, you know, guy, this guy must be an antichrist. I don't understand why that is happening. But to make it worse, even my mom is against me. She said, I wanted you, I prayed for years that you will come to know Christ. And instead of you knowing Christ, you're going to a Sabbath-keeping church. And even the mom is upset with him and doesn't want to have anything to do with him. Now, the problem why he said he was thinking of killing himself was the dad told him 2 days before he called me. He said, by next week, if I don't see you in the mosque, I'm going to shoot you. Now, in the northern part of Nigeria, the far north, which is predominantly Muslims, fairly much like the savannah, they probably can get away with that. The father can get away with that. Now, in the south, in the middle belt, in the east, no, not possible to get away with that. But in the north, yes, it's possible to get away with that. In most of those states, it's Sharia law that runs. We probably know what Sharia law means. The Muslim law is what obtains. And one of the things they say is if you have a son who seems to be going against the tenets of Allah, if you kill that son, you're doing God a service and you'll get some reward. Now, he's dependent on his father for his education, for his upkeep and everything. And he's saying, I don't understand. This is not reasonable. Why is God allowing me to go through that? I expect that it will make things easier for me, but things are just difficult. What am I going to do? Isn't it better for me to just kill myself? Or is it reasonable? Or should I just go back? But I can't see myself going back into the mosque and doing those things that I had known I'm not supposed to do again. There's also another young man, and my sermon here is the aftermath of my discussion with Emmanuel and a few other people. Like I said, during that week, a number of things came up together, and I put together this sermon. A young man called Oladimeji. Been in the church about 8 years now. His parents live in another state. Again, he's from a polygamous family, and the father has multiple wives, and his own mom somehow along the line had some issues with his dad, and so they're separate. Okay, the mom's still a Muslim, and so he's been living with his mom for long, but the father still takes care of them and pays their school fees. And so for 8 years, as a teenager of 19, he came to the church. And of course, his dad and his mom, they didn't know that he is now a Christian. He entered university to study law, and it's a 5-year program. And in his final year, he had his project to do, the last year. And it was going to cost a little bit, roughly about almost equivalent of $2,000 for him to go through, finish that year. And so he went to his dad. And it seemed somehow the dad had found out a few weeks before he had to go collect his money for that session, that he was no longer a Muslim. And his dad asked him, "I heard that you don't go to the mosque again, and that you're now a Christian, that you go to church, and on a Saturday." And he said, "Yes." "So all these years, that's what you've been doing?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Okay. You know, I'm going to cut you off completely. I'm not going to pay your school fees, and I don't want to have anything to do with you, and I'll disown you as my son if you don't come home next week and start going back to be a Muslim." And then Dimeji came to me and said, "Bros." Sometimes they call it, when you want to call someone a brother, you say, "Bros." He said, "Bros, I don't know what to do. Why is this happening at this time? 5 years I've been in school. This is the last session. Why did God let this happen at this time? What am I supposed to do? Am I going to risk my future and throw away 5 years? Because I do know my dad. He's really troublesome and he's stubborn and a little bit difficult person to cope with. And what's more, it's a thing of prestige or pride. Because the father has a mosque that he built in his hometown. And so for the people to say the son of an imam is now a Christian. I mean, if he were in the far north, the father would put a fatwa on him that they should kill him. If he were in the northern part of Nigeria, the father would do that easily. But in the south, the best he could do is to disown him as a son. And the image was, how could this happen? What am I supposed to do? What if I just go and tell him, okay? Is it not reasonable? Will God not understand if I just go and say, okay, I agree. And I'm just going to be home for like 2-3 weeks during the holidays. And he pays my school fees. And then I'm back to Lagos and I'm in school. And once I finish, I get a job. I don't have to depend on him again. Will it be unreasonable of me to do that? And will God not understand my doing that? A 50-year-old man. He's been in the church for a couple of years too. Probably maybe 10 years or so. He lives in a single room, a little smaller than the back room there. He has a daughter who is in college, and his job as a security man doesn't fetch him much money. As a security man who stays in open gates in a company for people to go in and come out. And during the feast last year, he wanted some assistance, and I told him, "I'm sorry, you just tied my hand. There's just nothing I could do. You don't tie." Now, he was upset. He said, "Excuse me, Mr. Kimball." I said, "So you've not paid a single tithe in years?" I used my access second sight for years to have you come to the feast, hoping you will at least understand some things. But I cannot use my access second sight. And of course, I cannot use the church assistance to give you anything. And he was really upset. So, Mr. Kimball, you have been unreasonable. Even God will understand. How can you expect me to pay tithes on what I'm earning? It's barely enough to take care of my needs. God is not so unreasonable. When God blesses me and I have enough, and I'm able to take care of needs, sure I will tithe. I'm not like you. You have a good job. I'm not like you. In a congregation of 65, think about four of us have our own vehicles in Nigeria, in Lagos. In Benin, only two people, congregation of about 25. And in Owerri, none. Okay, Coleman has a vehicle. An old vehicle, frankly, I'm ashamed to say. I bought the vehicle, what we call second hand. It's been used in New Jersey for like 11 years. And someone bought it, took it to Nigeria. The person used it for 7 years. Then I bought it from that person. And I used it for 7 years. And then I gave it to Coleman. And he's still using it now. And he's the only one who has a vehicle in Owerri. And everybody looks at him as, this guy's a big man. He has a vehicle. I call the vehicle Old Faithful. Served me and Mr. Nicholson driving all over Nigeria for a number of years. And so, oftentimes what people say is it's not reasonable for God to expect us to do certain things. During the days of unleavened bread, we expected to clear leaven out of our house. A new member who's been around for a year, also about 2 weeks ago, said, I heard you talking about, you know, I was talking to some of the singles and they were saying we need to remove every type of leavening and food with leaven out of our house. But I was telling them, okay, I'll just, you know, take all the things that has leaven because there are quite a number of them. And I'm going to just keep them either in my shed or in the garage, in the compound, or give them to my neighbor. And the singles are telling him, one of them was saying, no, you can't do that. You're supposed to destroy them or take them out completely. So he came to me and said, I mean, what are they talking about? What do they mean we should destroy them? I said, well, I think we should look at what God says. He said, well, he said, take them out of your house. If I remove them from my house and I put them in the garage, is it not out of my house? I said, but it's still your property. It's still part of your house. He said, well, if I give it to my neighbor, who could they give it to in Israel? Leaven is supposed to symbolize sin, isn't it? Are you going to remove it and say, okay, let me keep it with my neighbor for some time? The zeal, the fervor with which we choose to obey God will often show in the things we are willing to do or not willing to do for God. I said, look, you know that days of unleavened bread is still a couple of weeks away. You either start eating those food right now, and if you have to invite people to your house and share it with them, you do so. But how much even of those food will you have in your house? Not much. Now, his own argument was this. Mr. Kimball, you know how tough it is to get money these days. And I've used money to buy these things. And you're expecting me to just throw them away because it's the days of unleavened bread. Even God will not be that unreasonable. Are you telling me, don't you think that is a little stupid? So, it made me decide to talk on the sermon title that I have, which I have called An Unreasonable God. An Unreasonable God. And the question is, do we have an unreasonable God? In some of the things he expects of us, is he unreasonable in the demands he makes of us? I have young men in my congregation who are 37 years old, 38 years old. Young ladies, 34, 35, 31, 32. And they're singles. Now, the reason mostly is because the men are still staying with their folks. You stay with your folks for as long as possible. While it's expensive to rent a house, one of the ladies who worked for me, Meekness, one of my staff, she's been staying with her auntie and her uncle, who are not members of the church. And they've been doing a lot for a year that she's been in Lagos and working with me to just frustrate her. Oftentimes, she'll get home, or especially on weekends, they will deliberately prepare food and put crayfish or prawn inside. And they'll tell her, if you're not going to eat the food we're cooking in this house, you cannot cook anything else. And it's, of course, what we used to go buy food outside that you eat once. You can use it if you have them. If you're buying the foodstuffs and cooking it, you probably can use it to eat like twice or three times. And for someone who has to take transport to work and back, it's not economical for you to be buying food and going to restaurants to eat. Restaurant business, they don't do that well at home. And the mom visited and experienced that. The mom and the dad has been in the church from worldwide. They are currently with the Church of God in Wales, but at least they approve of the fact that she's in the Church of God and she's in United. And so they visited and they talked to me and they said, please, if there's anything you can do to help her to get out of this, we will appreciate it. So what she does sometimes is for like a month, she will stay in my house and only go home maybe once a month so that at least her aunties and uncle will not feel that, oh, is it because your boss is also living in Lagos and you just prefer to go stay there with them? And so finally, for about 4 or 5 months, she was looking for accommodation, especially as she's planning to get married like next year. She found a small room. We call it a self-contained room. And the size of the room literally is about here. That's the size of the room. And out of that room, if she puts a 4x6 bed, the little space left in front is about this size. And she's to pay about $1,200 a year, and she has to pay 2 years' rent. And so if it were not possible for me to give her an assistant to help pay that money and take it out of her salary over a period of, I'm actually spreading that money out for 2 years for her to pay for it. So it wouldn't really bite deep into her income. She would have had no choice than to stay with her uncle and aunties. And she's 29 years old. In Nigeria, respect for the elderly and obedience to your parents is a cultural thing. And even though nowadays it's not as bad as it used to be, but people feel that it's an obligation and not a choice to respect your parents or your elders. Everyone who is old enough to be my dad in Nigeria, I see them as my parents. And they relate to me as if they're my parents. Every child who is old enough to be my son, I can relate to it as if he or she is my son. If I see them doing something that is not proper, I can correct them and talk to them as strongly as I'll talk to my son. And they will respond without thinking, who are you? You're not my dad. No, they wouldn't. So she'll have had to stay in her parent, in those relatives' house and take everything. So the problem is, this young man that I talked about, Emmanuel, Akim, or Oladimeji, the 50-year-old man, and the other young man that didn't want to throw away his leavened bread, have a reason to believe that there are certain times and certain situations where you just have to do something that is against what God says, because it will be unreasonable to do so. They feel there are situations where you can look at something and say, you know what? Oh, this one's just this one, so it doesn't really matter. There's someone who's been looking for a job. He's 38 years old. 38 years old. He had a fiancée that is planning to get married in about a year's time, as of 2 years ago, but he just couldn't get a regular job. And he's an architect. And after a year and a half, the fiancée broke up with him. Said, look, this is going nowhere. We're just floating. And so maybe I should just call it off. Maybe there are some other guys who are ready. Anyway, in December, he got a job. But that job requires him to work for 6 months, and he has to work on Sabbath. And the money he will get in that 6 months, being a building project, is actually enough to set him up that he could get married, he could rent a 3 flats, an apartment, and he could still have enough It's almost like what you can say a regular 3-year salary. That was the job. And he came to me and said, what can I do? It seems God has finally heard my prayers. He has landed me this job. But look what he said. I have to be on site for 6 months. I asked them if they could exempt me, even if I'm on site for 6 months, and I can keep the Sabbath, even if I'm not able to leave the site, at least I can keep the Sabbath. They said, no, you have to work on Saturday. They said they will not even entertain it. If you know it's not going to work on Sabbath, forget it. So what am I going to do? Will it be unreasonable for me to take that job? Will God not understand? Will God not understand? And so, when I was speaking to Emmanuel and all these people, first thing I tried to tell them is this. Do you believe what Hebrews 11:6 says, that if you want to worship God, you must know that He exists? Do you believe God exists? And they say yes. Do you believe what Jeremiah 29:11 says? When God says, I know my plans towards you. I know my thoughts towards you. They're thoughts of peace. Not to harm you or destroy you, but to give you a hope and an expected end. Do you believe that? Because if you don't believe what God says, we may not have a basis for talking. And they'll say, yes, we do believe so. Then you also believe that God says, nothing shall separate you from my love. More or less, Paul was talking in Romans 8. I think from verse 35 to 39. So what shall separate us from the love of God? In Hebrews 13:5, it says, I will never leave you or forsake you. Do you believe that? Can we trust God's words? When He says something, does He exaggerate? Or does He say what He doesn't mean? And they said, no. I said, okay. If we want to go through the Christian life, if we want to work with God, we must take away one thing from our minds. The understanding or the belief that everything that God is going to require of us, or the things that we will be faced with in our walk with God, will always make sense to us. You have to understand that we serve a God who sometimes to us seems unreasonable and does certain things and expects certain things of us that are unreasonable. If we cannot wrap our minds around that, we might be walking on thin ice. I said, we think things are tough. Well, they're going to get tougher. That's what the scripture says. Let's look at Matthew 24. The book of Matthew chapter 24 from verse 9. We think things are tough. Well, they are tough, and they will get tougher. That's what the scripture says. And when I talk to Emmanuel, I say, Emmanuel, this is a really tough situation you're in. But I know one thing. There's something I'm sure of. God says He will never leave you or forsake you. He says He will never allow you to be tempted beyond your ability to bear. That He will always leave a way of escape. But look at what it says in Matthew 24 from verse 9. I will read from verse 9 to the number 13. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation. These are events or conditions or circumstances that will be in place just prior to Christ's coming. We might be the one that will experience that if all indications of what is happening is there. But because we do not know when we will have to go to sleep, we have to live as if today will be our last. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. Christ was talking to the disciples. Imagine if you have been called to a glorious future, to a great opportunity to be refined by God, to be taught by God, and you have been told that you have been prepared to be someone who will walk with the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords and the Creator of the universe. And then He starts telling you, well, along the process of walking with me, for me to prepare you for this great, wonderful, super job, they will kill you. They will deliver you up to tribulation. They will hate you. All the nations will hate you for my sake. And you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended exactly because of that. Because you do not expect that God the creator of the universe, the one who has everything and controls everything and has all power, will allow his own to be ridiculed. He said, many will be offended. Many people will betray one another and they will hate one another. Then he talks about many false prophets rising up and deceiving many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will wax cold. The love of many will grow cold. But he who endures, how do I say that? Endures to the end shall be saved. Malachi chapter 3 verse 3. Malachi chapter 3 verse 3. And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. And he shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold, or purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering of righteousness. We're preparing for the feast days of unleavened bread and the Passover. A time when we're supposed to examine ourselves. Now we should be doing that on a regular basis. But much more so at this time. To look at ourselves, look at our lives. Look at those things that we often think do not matter at all. Things we feel look just this once, or in this situation and this circumstance. I think God will understand. He's not an unreasonable God. Brethren, I submit to you that we actually do have an unreasonable God. But only if we think it is unreasonable and if we don't understand what his plans for us, for his world, what those plans are. We walk on really thin ice if we're expecting every situation to be reasonable. I have the youngest in my family is 29 years old. My youngest sister, she's 29. I dearly love her very much. We do communicate. And she was brought up in the same family. Same mother, same father. We were brought up in the church. My dad left the church when I was like 7 years old. I came back when I was 16. I started bringing my sisters. It took my mom about 12 years to get the courage to come back. My dad still doesn't like the fact that we're all in the church, but okay, we are. My youngest sister attended with us for many years, and then she is very talented, very, very talented, and she sings. And several of my sisters actually won awards as best soloist or best female singer in various competitions when they were in school in Nigeria. And my youngest sister is fairly known in the pop world, not just in Nigeria, I think generally, not in the class of Michael Jackson or so, but You Google Neola and you'll see her and she's recorded a number of albums. Every few times I just get to talk to her. I said, I know, what are you doing? You can't live your life as if everything is just about now. You don't know how tomorrow will be. And she said, look, my bros, God knows my heart. I just can't at this time face those decisions now. I'm just trying to sort myself out and be the best I can be and get the best I can get right now. Later on, when I'm established, maybe when I'm married, because, I come to the church and I'm going to have to marry within the church or within the faith. Now, I don't want to tie myself to that. Look at my sister, and I have a 34-year-old sister who is still single. And I said, that's not true. Any church, there are more women in Nigeria than there are men. And I joke. It did say in the Bible that a time will come when seven women will say a man. Will tell, we just want to carry your surname. I said, that's not true. Go anywhere else. You can see ladies who are ready for marriage, but they're not getting married. Probably because, again, the economy is different. It's bad. Many of them, those who really want to settle, cannot afford to do so. And then again, probably because the world has become so permissive that people enjoy the benefits of marriage when they are not married. So what's the point, in a sense? I said, probably, but it's not just a question of in the church, it's anywhere. And so God looks at my heart. He knows I love him. He knows that I want to do it, but I just can't at this time. This is not the right time. God is not an unreasonable God. He ought to understand I need to achieve my dream first. Then I can come back and give my life to him. Or follow what he wants me to do. We cannot go into the Passover. We cannot go through the days of unleavened bread and not examine ourselves and look in our lives and see if there are decisions. Some little things we call little things, but are still sins. Some compromises we have made or that we keep making when it is convenient. And assume that we have purged ourselves completely of leaven, as we're supposed to do, as symbolic by the process of going through this of unleavened bread. God is going to purify his own. He wants to be able to say the same thing he said in Genesis 22:12 of Abraham. Now I know. Now I know. And if we don't get out of this mindset that, you know, God is not an unreasonable God, he ought to understand. Imagine Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Babylon. And they were asked to bow down to an idol. And if they don't do it, they were going to be killed, thrown into the furnace. Imagine if they were to have that mindset, God is not an unreasonable God. I mean, this is our lives. Our parents had been probably killed or taken captive. And God has spared us so that we can continue to worship him and serve him in this pagan world. He wouldn't want us to just go die like that, like chickens. Okay, you know, our life is really at stake. We've always known that we should love God. We should worship God. He's the only true God. We know these heathens don't even understand what they're doing. It's just an idol. Okay? Because we know God understands. Here's what we're going to do. Imagine them talking to themselves. When they blow the trumpet and everybody else is bowing to that idol, because God looks at the heart, isn't it? And it's just this once. It's not every day they're going to be asking us, even if it's just for a month or 2 months. Okay, we'll just bow down to the idol. I mean, just this once. Because God will not want us to just die like that. I mean, he did say that there is no way to praise you in the grave, isn't it, in the Bible? So, God will understand. He wouldn't want us to just die like that. So, the trumpet blows, and they decide to bow down to the idol. You know what? They could go a little further. Okay, we know this is nothing but an idol. And so, what we're going to do is this. When the trumpet blows, we will bow down, but in our minds, we'll be thinking of the great God who is in heaven. Will God understand? I don't know. He probably wouldn't. I submit he wouldn't. He will be unreasonable enough to expect them to do his will, period. And they said, we all know what they said, God is able to deliver us. And even if he does not, forget it. There's no question about us bowing down to that idol. So why does God oftentimes act in ways that seem unreasonable to us? Why does he allow us to be in situations where we are faced with a choice that if we do the right thing that we want to do or that we know we ought to do, it costs us something? Or it might cost us big or huge. Why does he allow such situations? Is it that unreasonable? Does he expect us to often make decisions that to us will be unreasonable? Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8. From verse 2. Talking to the Israelites, and I believe it also talking to us, the Israel of God. And you shall remember, from 2 to 3, that the Lord your God led you all the way, this 40 years in the wilderness, to humble you and test you, to humble you and to test you, to know what was in your heart, to know what was in your heart, whether you will keep his commandments or not. God is offering us co-rulership with his son, Jesus Christ. The Bible says we'll be co-heirs with Christ. That's a huge responsibility. He's not just going to give it to us. He wants to know what is in our heart. What will you and I do if faced with a difficult situation? Will we always do the right things? Or we're going to say, you know, in this situation, God will understand. He's not an unreasonable God. Oh, he is an unreasonable God when it comes to such situations. So he humbled you and allowed you to hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that it might make you know the man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. He gave his all for us. He wants us to be willing to also give our all to him. If we will only obey God and do what he wants when it is convenient, that is not worship. Once, when David offended God, and he sent an angel of death, and I believe we all know this story in the book of Kings and Chronicles, to go among the people, and he was killing them, and he was to make a sacrifice so that it would stop. And he got to the threshing floor of Arunah. And he asked him that, look, this is what I want to do. I want to make a sacrifice to God, oxen, place to put the altar and everything I need. And Arunah said, oh, king, this is all you need, you know? Just take them. They're yours. Just use it and use it to do this sacrifice. After all, it's for people of Israel. They're my people too. And David said, no, I will pay for this. I will not make a sacrifice to my God that cost me nothing. I will not make a sacrifice to my God that cost me nothing. Do we want to worship God when it costs us nothing? The times when everything is cool, it's easy for everybody to do that. It's easy to be nice to those who smile at you. What if someone punches you on the nose and tomorrow you see him in trouble? Can you go to him and help him? Can we do that? Now, it has cost us maybe pride. Maybe it has cost us something to just do that, okay? Let me swallow my pride. What if someone offends you and hasn't apologized and continues to be obnoxious? Can we forgive that person? You know, it says if your brother sins against you and it says, I'm sorry, you forgive him. 70 times 7. If he says, I'm sorry, forgive him. What if he doesn't say, I'm sorry? Ah! He didn't say, I'm sorry. Then I can't forgive him. We cannot think we are delivering ourselves if we still have such thoughts, such mindset in us. I'm not turning there, but in Luke 18, when Christ was again on this issue of forgiveness, they were talking about faith. And he said, increase our faith. And he told them the story of a servant who will come home and take care of the master. And the master will not tell him, go, you know, take care of yourself and then come and serve me. He said to him in, I think, verse 17, he said, if you have done what is expected of you, we shall say we are unprofitable servant. It's not a choice. It's not a choice. God allows us to go through difficult situations where we'll have to make decisions that may sound or seem unreasonable because he wants to test us, wants to humble us, wants to know what's in our heart. What he wants to give us is huge. The same book of Deuteronomy chapter 8. The same thing was repeated in verse 15 of Deuteronomy 8. Say, he led you through that great and terrible wilderness in which were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock, fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know. Why did he do that? Why did he take them through the wilderness? Why did he allow them to go through thirst and hunger and fed them and took care of them? Why did he even allow them to go through those problems? They had suffered enough in Egypt, generations of slavery. Many had their children killed before Moses came to deliver them. And now they finally have been delivered. Don't you expect that this will be easy street? I mean, shouldn't God look at all the suffering they've gone through and just make things easy for them and just take them through everything without trouble? But he led them through the wilderness where there were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land. And he said that he might humble you and that he might test you to do you good in the end. And that's my punchline. To do you good in the end. Emmanuel is still alive. He didn't shoot himself. I spoke with him about 2 hours online. And I said, Emmanuel, I can't tell you what to do. But I can show you examples of people that what you are going through is not new to you. I haven't gone through that. I didn't come close to that. When I was 17 and counseling for baptism, after I had started coming to church, my dad wasn't very happy about it. And I called him and my mom. I said, I'm counseling for baptism. It means right now my first allegiance is to God. I have to do what I believe God wants me to do. And then I will look at my conscience. I know I'm supposed to obey you and honor you without question, okay? But not when it goes against God's will. I will honor you, I'll respect you, I will listen to what you say, but if it goes against what I believe is what in my heart God asked me to do, then I'm sorry, I won't do it. I will be respectful, I will be honorable, but I will still not do what you want. Now, I knew my dad. He stood up. So you're talking to me? Huh? Me? You're the one I'm talking to. You're the one. I'm the one you're talking to. He stood up and went inside. Now, when my dad, in the past, if he does that, he's going into a coma with a whip. It's a PVC wire. Our parents oftentimes will beat their 16, 17, 20, 22-year-old kids. I left my parents when he was my father's house when I was 27. And I moved in with a friend of mine. And I left on account of the fact that one of my sisters, who was 23, was to be flogged. And I told my dad, I said, you know, you can't keep doing this. I mean, she's 23. If it wasn't for economy, she should be married or on her own. She's 23. You cannot be flogging her. She's a lady as well. And it became a big issue. And so I left and tried. In fact, the moment I got my own house, my own place, my own room, all my 6 sisters, all of them just moved out of the house. Well, my parents were happy to let them go because then the responsibility is mine. So he went to the house and I told my mom, I said, look, mom, if he comes back with a whip and touches me, I will walk out of this house and I won't come back. And you know what? I will sleep under the bridge, and if I'm mugged or I'm killed or whatever happens, I will die happy. But I'll die happy knowing that I have lived my life the way I wanted. I used to joke a lot, hardly serious, the clown of the house. And for me to see that, I think my mom took it very seriously. And so she went in to talk to my dad, and he didn't come back. He didn't come out again. And in a sense, that was the day my dad began to give me some respect in the house. So, people back home go through certain situations that they will feel, you know, in this situation, this is what I need to do. So I said, Emmanuel, I can't imagine the situation you are in, and I can't tell you this is what you ought to do. But here's what I can tell you. There are people who have had to face such decisions, and I took him through Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I went through the promises of God in Scripture that I will sustain you, I will carry you into your old age, I will never leave you, never will I forsake you. I went through the book of Hebrews with him, where he talks about people who conquered, people who God delivered. And then he talks about people who were tortured and killed and were sawn asunder. Now, it doesn't sound reasonable that faithful people, people God imputed righteousness into and say, yes, these are good people, righteous people, he will allow some of them to be delivered and he will allow some of them to be killed. I don't know how truly, but I read that Isaiah, one of the greatest prophets who wrote about 2/3 of the prophets in the Bible, was tied to 4 horses I'm pulled into four places. There was a movie I watched a couple of years ago, maybe 10, 12 years ago, called Badis, that chronicled and tried to show how the Christians are massacred and martyred during the time of Nero. These were God's people. These were people who were following what God wanted. And yet, why would God allow them to be killed like chickens, as we say back home? It doesn't sound reasonable. If we can't step back and look at the big picture and understand why God is doing this, which he says in Deuteronomy is for our good, to do us good, then we will stumble. We will be offended. And we will not be removing those leavening, strong leaven. We might think they're small leaven because, you know what? Oh, those things come up once in a while, you know, and God understands those occasional times when we do those things. Oh, he doesn't understand. A number of my friends, and when they are thinking of coming to America, I tell them, you know, I can understand people coming to America and they don't want to go back. Everything is structured. Even when you're driving on the road, the scenery is peaceful. You know, you're relaxed. I often say the rules here, no disrespect, you know, it's like the rules are made for sissies. I mean, no disrespect, okay? It's assuming that the people driving are like what? They're like babies. Let me give an example. You need to be on your toes when you're driving in Nigeria. They used to say that if you can drive in Nigeria, you can drive anywhere. I think my 12-year-old son can probably drive here. I mean, the rules are so easy. I think sometimes it's like this is a little kid, so you need to tell them how to turn here, how to drive this way, you must slow at this time, and everything is enforced. Okay, good. We were coming from Chattanooga, and there was a vehicle parked or so on the side of the road. And Dad was telling me that here, when you're passing a vehicle that is on the side of the road, you either move to the other side or either you slow down very well. I said, okay, I can understand slowing down. But why must I move to the other side? He said, well, because, you know, the other person might just come out and you might hit. Is he a what? Is he a baby? You mean he's going to come out of the road without looking? Where would someone in his mind, in his sane person, come out of the road, come out of the side into the main road without checking to be sure? And you know what? How can somebody who is coming behind not see someone who is driving and anticipate the possibility that he might come out? You just have to work like that. And then, it's a free road. Okay? And there's someone who is in front of you, and you're moving at 70 miles per hour. Every time you see 70 miles, 55 miles, 45 miles. Wow, it's good. I mean, that's why I said, you know, even my son can drive here. I'm not saying they're bad rules. And people will come here and they will look at the fact that there's electricity every time. If we have power for 4 hours in about 3 days, we will say, wow. They're really trying. It's improving. Every house will have at least two or three generating sets if they can afford to. But almost every business will have even the smallest one. The smallest gen, about 100 kVA. Costs about $120, $130. Every business will have one. So it's understandable. People come here and they look at everything and wow, this is really great. And it's great. Okay? And then I tell them too, but you must also understand that you cannot take America and think of all the good without looking at the bad side. And there are bad sides everywhere. In my country, there are lots of bad sides. In America, I believe there are lots of bad sides as well. And a few of my friends who have actually emigrated to some parts of Europe, they complain and complain about all the bad things. Will you guys quit complaining? People back home look at you as, you know, in a really nice place. And it's true. You're in a really nice place. You expect to always have good things and not expect to have some side effects. What do they complain about? Oh, some of the kids have almost no respect for their parents. Oh, the culture of sex, oh, it's much. Drugs, you're always afraid of what your kids are going to be forced to do in school. We don't have to worry about that at home. I've heard of cases where they said someone will go somewhere, a young man or young, will shoot some other people, and you don't have a problem. So every area has its good and its bad. In working with God as well, we can't expect everything to always be reasonable or smooth. In fact, we probably will face more situations where we will have to make decisions that to other people might look or seem unreasonable. One you might understand easily is the issue of the colors coming to Africa. When they were young, they would come to Africa for the feast. Now, I'm not talking of going to maybe a place in Kenya where you have really Western-style environments and you're always moving from one air-conditioned vehicle to another and you're paying some premium, you know, money for being taken care of. They will come to Nigeria. He'll probably tell you his first feast in Nigeria. You have roaches on the bed. We don't have that again. But you won't have air condition. The roads will be dirty or dusty. There will be probably potholes big enough to swallow your vehicle. And when you're driving, you can imagine, rock me, rock me, rock me, baby, because you're rocking like this when you're driving. Because the springs of the vehicle, they're probably 20, 30 years old. I think it's unreasonable for someone who is used to enjoying the life that they have in America and who could afford to stay and keep their feet in America to want to come to Nigeria or Togo or Republic of Benin and keep the feast. And they will be uncomfortable. And yet, they do it willingly. Sometimes I think we Christians are getting to forget the fact that we're supposed to be soldiers. When Paul was talking about Christians being Christian soldiers, he was thinking of Romans, the Roman soldiers. The discipline was much. But sometimes we're all looking for the comfortable things. Okay? So we will not always have everything okay. I want to conclude by looking at a few people, some of the key people God dealt with in the scriptures. I will see some of the unreasonable situation or the unreasonable things that God has allowed in their lives. And yet these were people who will be among the key people in the kingdom of God. People we will talk to, we will relate with, God willing, if we all make it in his kingdom. Maybe I should start with Abel. Hebrews 11 verse 4. Abel. He says in Hebrews 11, 4, by faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous. God, testifying of his gifts, and through it, he being dead, still speaks. By the way, Emmanuel that I talked about, who was threatened to be shot, chose to tell his father that he wasn't going to come back and be a Muslim. And he decided that he was going to move to campus, and he went to talk to one of his uncle, who was also a Muslim, and explained to him what happened. And the uncle told him, you know, you ought to listen to what your father is saying. But if you really want to follow this way, I'll take care of your school fees. And once you are out of school, you're on your own. But you really should do what your father tells you to do. But if you still want to continue to be the Christian that you say you want to be, okay, I won't force you. And the uncle opted to take care of his education. The other guy, Dimeji as well, told his father that he wasn't going to be a Muslim. And the father told him, get out of my house. I will disown you as my son. And I don't want to have anything to do with you again. And he left. When he got back to school, the following week, he was wondering what he was going to do. And I was telling him, okay, just let me know when you need to pay the money. I'll see what I can do and assist you. And then he called me the day he was supposed to come collect the money from me. He said, you know, a list came out, what they call like a merit list for the final year students. And his CGPA was at the top. And they've given him a scholarship for that year. Not only that, they are giving him a bursary award. They're giving him the exact amount of the tuition as spending money for himself. It turned out also that 2 days later, his father had paid the exact amount of his tuition into his account. And the father actually died 4 days afterwards. Who knows? 4 days afterwards, the father died. But he had not only did he pay the money, he got a bursary award and he got a scholarship. That turned out well. But I just imagine what could have happened. What if he had chosen to pretend to follow along with the father? Maybe God just wanted to reward him. I think God knows what we need every time. He knows when we need encouragement. And he knows when he sometimes needs to just toughen us up. He knows. We have to be willing to yield to him. I know his will is perfect. Abel was a righteous person. God accepted his offering. And what happened? His brother came, killed him. Now, there were just very few people still alive then, I guess. And this is one of the people who God really liked, and he was following God's will. Why did God allow Abel to be killed? Was he on a safari at that time? Was he napping somewhere? Or was he resting under the shade in the garden or somewhere in heaven and the cloud are taking him somewhere or what? This was someone he approved of his sacrifice, and God watched as the brother killed him. And when the brother became scared that people will see him and they're going to kill me, what did God do? An unreasonable act. I will put a sign on you that anyone who steals you will not kill you. Will I make such a choice? Well, I wouldn't. That's why I guess I'm not God. Why would God do that? To protect Cain from being killed when he did nothing to protect Abel in the first place. To me, that is a little bit unreasonable. Maybe not a little bit. Let's look at Noah. Hebrews 11 verse 7. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. Noah is called in the scriptures, 1 Peter 2:5, a preacher of righteousness. How long did he preach while building the ark? 120 years. 120 years. I'm sure he had brothers and sisters. He had relatives. Was it a hard thing for God to call any of them to go into the ark with him? Was it such a difficult thing for God to do? But only his wife and his three sons and their wives. I'm not so sure Noah will go into the ark knowing his brothers, his sisters, his relatives just didn't understand. I'm sure it probably pained him that none of them was willing to at least understand what God was telling him. But I don't believe it was impossible for God to touch their heart. Wasn't it God who had in the heart of Pharaoh? Okay, couldn't he have at least softened their heart so that the entire family of Noah will go into the ark? And you know what? After they get out, he could leave them again and let them decide to choose. Maybe that experience of really seeing the flood might convict them and they might choose to just start obeying God. But he left it. He left it. Only Noah and his family. Only 8 of them. Abraham, a wealthy man by any standard in his time. Leave your people, your town, go into a place I will take you to. And Abraham followed God's instructions. And God told him, your children will be as numerous as the sands on the seashore. Imagine if God had told me, my kids will be as numerous as the sands on the seashore. I will expect that every year, my wife will be having at least three kids. Triplets! I'll be eager to see the triplets, and I wouldn't worry because God told me that will happen. He will take care of them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Abraham's wife did not have a child. I think it's a little bit unreasonable. You know how hope the fast make the heart faint? Abraham was actually getting a little bit discouraged. In fact, in Genesis 15, when he was getting a little bit discouraged and wondering, you know what, God, you've been telling me all these promises. I know you're God, but look, it's only a servant born in my house who will even be my heir. I don't even have a son. And you keep making all these promises. Just go through from Genesis 12, 13, 14, 15. By 17, I was getting a little bit discouraged. And I think God wanted to encourage him. And how did God encourage him? Say, okay, you know what? Take some animals and some doves and, you know, prepare a sacrifice for me. And then as he was put the things together, God put a deep sleep on him. You all know this. Right? I'm not turning there. And how did God encourage him? He started by saying, you know, verily I say unto you, truly assuredly I say unto you, you don't doubt this. This is a fact. Your children will be slaves for 400 years in a foreign land. Now that is encouraging, isn't it? Really encouraging. Okay, maybe take that out. Abraham figured, okay, my children will be slaves, but I will visit them and I'll take them out. Well, I can console myself. He said, I will visit them and I'll take them out, and they will eventually own this place. And then he told him he was going to have his son. And then 25 years after the promise, he had a son. Woo! I imagine him just jumping when Sarah would say, Abraham, you know, I think that I miss my period. And Abraham was like, sorry, can you say that again? And then imagine the joy of Abraham and Sarah. Imagine the joy in their old age. They tried to look for a shortcut with Ishmael. And God said, don't worry, it's your own children, your own child. And then a couple of years afterwards, God told Abraham, Genesis 22. Imagine what God told him in Genesis 22. It's on there. It will probably have shocked Abraham. It came to pass, verse 1, after this thing that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. Then he said, take now your son. Now, in case Abraham is thinking, oh, I have all my slave sons are my sons. They're like my sons, isn't it? God said, your only son, Isaac. No doubt about who I'm talking about. And then he said, whom you love. It's like a barb. Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. I know you love him a lot. That guy, yes, him and him. Not the other Isaac. That's the only son of that other slave woman that is also your, like your son as well. No, that one whom you love, your son, Isaac. Go offer him as a burnt offering. Like they will say in the courts, I put it to you, ladies and gentlemen, that is an unreasonable request. It is an unreasonable request. But Abraham had a joker in the pack, so to say. Hebrews says he knew and believed that God was able to do what he had promised. And what did God promise him? Through this son Isaac, I will make you the father of many nations. Whoever must worship God must know that he exists and is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. Our God oftentimes does things and expects things of us that are unreasonable. And it can seem like an unreasonable God sometimes, but like he says in Deuteronomy 8, it is for our good and to test us and to know what is in our heart, to know whether we'll obey him or not. Just a couple of my examples and I'm done. What of Moses? Or maybe we should look at Joseph first. Verse 22 of Hebrews 11. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. He was a sweet little boy. Probably maybe about the age of Daniel, Carson, A little younger maybe, but I think he was about 13 or 17. I can't remember exactly now. And he had a dream. Now, who gave him that dream? God. That the sun and the moon and the stars were bowing down to him. In his exuberance, he went and told his dad and his mom. You know, that was the beginning of his problem, probably with his brothers. He was already a favorite. Oh, that's favorite. And he went and told them what God had shown him. Why did God not keep that dream to himself and just work out his will in this little boy's life? And God told him. And he went and told his parents and his brothers, and he despised them. And they saw an opportunity when he was sent to go give them food, and they sold him into slavery. How many 17-year-olds will be sold into slavery, or something happened to them that is entirely not their fault, will still have their trust and their faith in their God intact? How many 17-year-olds even have that strong of faith in God? As the world improves and grows in a sense, it also is deteriorating. It's very hard these days to find young men and women who are passionate for God. And who will not say, you know what? Oh, that's an unreasonable request. It's getting a little bit harder to find people like that these days. A culture, or the culture that is enticing to the young people these days, makes it difficult for them. They just want everything to make sense their own way. David was 17 when he challenged Goliath and said, I do not come at you with a sword, but I come in the name of the living God of Israel. 17. How old was Jeremiah? How old was Samuel? David was sent into slavery. I believe his faith in his God was still intact. And then he became exalted in Potiphar's house. And he was enticed by Potiphar's wife. And he still did what God wanted. And how was he rewarded? Prison. He still wasn't bitter. He still kept understanding that the will of God is perfect. He didn't understand it. It wasn't until his father died, probably until the famine and his people had to come to buy food. Because after his father died, he was telling his brothers, you people were thinking of evil, but God was using you to preserve our generation. It was to do him good in the end, and not just him, but every one of them. That is why God often allows us to go through those decisions, those situations, that we often therefore make decisions that we say, you know, God understands. He's not an unreasonable God. No, he allowed those unreasonable situations, put us in those unreasonable circumstances, so that he can actually develop us. Not to see whether we will fall or not, really to give us an opportunity to show how well we have grown. Exams are set for students. It's not designed to make them fail. It's designed to show how well they have learned. Moses, a prince, out of favor for God's people, killed someone and went to exile. 40 years from being a prince in Egypt to be a prince in the wilderness over sheep. 40 years. Now, why did God wait 40 years? Who knows? Not a problem. And then God appeared to him and sent him on an errand. And he protested and didn't want to do it. We can read about how he told God of all the reasons why he just couldn't do it. God said, look, this is what I will do. I'll take care of your inadequacies. And he sent Aaron. And then he went, spoke to Pharaoh. And what did God do? He hardened Pharaoh's heart. And the problem doubled more or less on the Israelites. And then all many plagues and everything, and people of Israel finally left. And Moses, saddled with what the Bible says in Deuteronomy as stiff-necked, stubborn people. The Bible says 10 times they grumbled against God. A couple of times God will tell Moses, get away from these people, let me destroy them. I will make you the one through whom I will fulfill my promise. And Moses said, no, please God, don't do this. It will ridicule you. People will say you couldn't fulfill your promise. So please don't do this. And then, I remember once, when he was coming down from receiving the Ark of the, the Ten Commandments, and met the golden calf, he exhibited a great anger, smashed it, ground it into powder, spread it in the water, and made the people drink it. And then the second time, when God told him, speak to this rock, and water will come there for this stubborn, grumbling, disobedient, untrusting, faithless people. And he was so angry that these people, in spite of everything that God had shown them, in spite of all the evidences of God's greatness, still didn't believe. And was so angry, he just went, you stop on people. Is it water you want? Okay, fine. You want water? This is water. And he hit the rock. And water came out. And God said, Moses, you're not supposed to hit the rock. You're supposed to speak to the rock. Because of this, you will not enter the promised land. Now, God had been angry a few times, if I remember. And he tried to destroy the people. Now, God was angry. He said, Moses, get out from them, I will destroy them. And Moses, one time he told Aaron, quick, get incense. Let's, try and appease him. Let's calm him down. Okay, calm down. Okay, take it easy. You can do that, God. Please, don't do that. And then he, out of anger. Is it anger at what God had told him to do? No. The people. In Deuteronomy 1:37, I won't turn there. He was telling the children of Israel, because of you, on your account, God said, I won't enter the promised land. He was not so happy with the Israelites. It's you people that caused God to not allow me to enter the promised land. But he accepted God's judgment. Frankly, to myself, even standing here, it seems unreasonable. But he's God. I have to trust that it is all to do him good in the end. I can't understand everything. Neither can we. You understand everything that's going to happen to you in life. All we can only do is to trust that God never lies. He cannot lie. It's impossible for him to lie. And if he says his plans for you and I are to give us a hope and expected end, then I believe it. Then we can believe it. If he asks us to do things that are unreasonable, then we do it. The just shall live by faith. One of the strongest leaven we need to remove from our lives, and we need to keep watching out for, is that leaven of thinking, God doesn't, God understand. It's a leaven of compromise. It's a leaven of compromise. And we need to keep examining ourselves on a regular basis to make sure that we don't say God doesn't understand. God understands. Oh, he's not unreasonable. Oh, he does things that are unreasonable, but all for our good. Okay, my final scripture. Okay, let me just tell you this story. Elisha was a prophet, isn't it? He died. What killed him? Sickness. He died of sickness. Now this is Elisha, a prophet of God, a powerful prophet. Probably got double portion of Elijah's power. And he died, he was sick in bed with the sickness with which he died. And then he became a skeleton in the sepulchre, in the grave. And the Israelites were going to bury someone, wrapped in linen. And the Amalekites were coming. And they saw them coming. And they dropped the dead body. We know the story. And the dead body fell into the grave and touched Elisha's bones. What happened? The dead body stood up and came to life. Huh? You mean there was that much power in his bones, in his body, and he died of sickness? Couldn't he have died in his sleep without a sickness? Isn't that the reasonable thing to expect from God? And yet, I often wonder why God put that story in the Bible. Sometimes I think it's just because God is... He has a sense of humor. And again, maybe to encourage us. Imagine the story. The people who drop the dead body run in to enter the city gate so they don't lock the gate before them. Lock them up. And then they will hear someone say, hey, please, wait for me. And they would look back and they see the person they just went to bury. I doubt how many of them you think will wait for that dead body. I don't know about here in the U.S. You guys sometimes are pretty brave. I bet you in Nigeria, the family of that man probably will refuse to have anything to do with him. They'll probably run to the gate and tell everybody else, close the gates, close the gates. And that guy is a ghost. Brethren, it's easy for us to look at the big, obvious things and say those things we don't do. It's those little things that we oftentimes say God understands. The little ways we compromise. The things we postpone or procrastinate doing that we know we ought to do are the things that we need to really work to work out of our system. God is a God who loves us. He's one who has invested a lot in us. He is rooting for us. He has everything in our favor. It's like we have a judge who is bent on making sure we are acquitted of whatever it is we are accused of. The advocate is also for us. The accuser of the brethren, the devil himself, will do his level best to get us to do things that we're not supposed to do. But if we can look within ourselves, recognize those things, those sins, those areas we fudge, we compromise, those areas we excuse, those situations and circumstances we think we cannot just do what God wants in this case because it will cost us. Sometimes it's a question of maybe it's getting married, maybe it's finance, maybe it's being in good standing with your boss or friends or family or neighbors or whatever it is. Those instances are instances where we can just look on God and say, God, I leave this in your hands. I just leave this in your hands. You say that if a man's way pleases you, you make even his enemies at peace with him. And so God, help me so that I can always please you, even if it sounds that you are being unreasonable. I will trust that you are doing this for my good. And I hope that by doing that, it will be easier for me the next time to show to God that, yes, what is my heart is, I desire to do His will. End of sermon. As Mr. Kellis was talking about in his announcement, when I was growing up in the church, a lot of the young men like me, a lot of young ladies, weren't so happy with the situation in the church. Most of our parents were very poor indeed. Many people couldn't even conclude or finish their secondary school or college education. I sometimes get confused what you mean by college or university. College and university are they the same? Oh, then it's not college I'm talking about. I'm talking of, we have elementary school. These days they have kindergarten, nursery, primary, secondary, and then college or university. Okay? Most of our parents then even believed when I came to the church in the early 80s that it's not even smart to educate your kids. Not only is it that it's expensive to do so because you have to pay for everything up front. If you don't have the money to pay for school, you can't go to school on credit. It's not done. So some of our parents also, because of some of the things that happened in the early 70s, many of them sacrificed for the church, for their beliefs, and some of them lost good jobs. And some of them couldn't keep good jobs because of their faith, because of their beliefs. And so a lot of my friends and the singles in the YOU then will often say, look, we need to pursue money. We need to pursue financial independence and stability first. And once you have that, then you now put God. How can you say you're pursuing God and serving God when you're thinking of how you're going to feed yourself or your family or take care of your basic needs? So run after taking care of your basic needs. Once that is settled, then you can have the peace of mind to worship God. It's like turning the other way around, what it says, seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all other things will be added. So, One of the things I proposed to do was to do my level best to show that you can serve God and yet things can work out for you. Because sometimes I think it's because we don't trust God enough. And sometimes just because, again, we're not smart or wise enough. It did say that the children of this world are wiser than the children of light. And so in the United Church of God, just like in the average family in Nigeria, things are pretty hard for a number of people. For those who are able to have an education, I had a master's degree. And I worked for 15 years in the pharmaceutical industry. I know I've said this before. And as of 2003, when I decided to start working for myself, my salary was about a little under $200 a month with a master's degree. My house rent was about $50 a month. My transportation and running expense for the month is almost another $80 to $100 a month. In fact, I will often collect what I call salary advance. I'll tell my employer, can I get half of my salary for next month, half of the one for the upper month, and half of the one for the upper month? So because I had six of my sisters, I have my mom, I have my dad, I have nieces, and so many people that you're trying to support. So there are many people in the church across Africa who just cannot get an education because the parents couldn't afford to. So most of them are busy doing one or two menial jobs, and some of them earn about maybe 50, 60 to average maybe about $100 a month. And so they stay with their parents. They keep doing that for years. And sometimes, because of course in the church, people know before you can get married, you have to have your own accommodation. So some of them will stay like that 30 years, 40 something years, and they're still single. For those who are fortunate to have an education, they finish and they get a job. And of course, for every five jobs, there are probably 1,000 people looking for the job. And then you get a job, you can't tell them that I will not work on the Sabbath. Oh, there are probably 50 people who will tell you I can work from Sunday to Sunday, easy. And so, a lot of them have faced various challenges over the years. And God has been faithful in some instances by He's always faithful. When I say in some instances, it's like I said, God chooses those people He will allow, He will encourage, and some God chooses their circumstances to test them and to strengthen them as well. So what we've been doing, what I've tried to do over the years, is to try and provide skills in areas that I know I have the strength and the connection or the ability, and a way by which some of the young ones can continue to improve their income and actually start taking care of their own education. I set up an education fund 4 years ago. And I tried to put apart about 10% of my income into that fund and try to encourage parents to put their children in school, pay for their school fees, buy textbooks for them. Twice, ABC students and some congregations have also contributed to that fund in the past. And that is, we still continue to do so. Because the belief is if we can raise the level of education of the people, they can at least get some basic income. And that might change the generation in one or two generations. There are families where they have four children, five children, live in a single room. And some of the kids, you look at them, you think they're probably, I think some of them are marasmic, or they have what is called kwashioko. And so my wife and some of the singles organized visiting. This was an initiative that some of the singles brought up and discussing with my wife. And they will visit them on a rotatory basis and take some foodstuffs, raw foodstuffs to them. We already are assisting the parents with school fees so that they can spend more of that money in at least getting more food and taking care of the children. And where we have needs too, we have provided some of them opportunity to move from a small accommodation to a slightly bit better accommodation, and then given them opportunities by helping them to expand the business they do. Some of them are people who sell what we call petty things. And everything they sell, they may have a small kiosk like this in front of their house. And they have things like matches, some cubes of sugar, tea bags, some sachet milk, and everything in their kiosk you might buy for like $50 equivalent to $100. Everything in their kiosk. So maybe on a daily basis, maybe they make like, my mom set up something similar for my mom a few years ago. And maybe on a daily basis, most of them, maybe they make like $1, $2, $3 a day. So that's about how the average person is. Among the young adults, people in their 20s upwards, what I did last year was to, as I visited, because I saw the same thing in Cameroon, I saw the same thing in Ghana, saw the same thing in Togo, saw the same thing in the Republic of Benin. And there were quite a lot of them, people in their late 20s, people in their early 30s, ladies and men. Some of them are just too old now to go back to schools, in a sense. And some of them have finished their basic elementary school, but they can't afford to go to a higher institution. So I've been doing for about 4 years in Lagos, organizing to train most of the young adults in various applications, providing IT skills where they can troubleshoot basic troubles on hard laptops, desktops, where they can offer services to what we call business centers, people where they have a computer, a cyber cafe, and people can go and type things. So if they have needs, they can just get jobs in those places. And then I've been organizing training on CMS websites using Drupal, Joomla, and working to provide websites, because Google, that I also work with on a consultancy basis, has what is called a GABO initiative, Get African Businesses Online in Nigeria. And what they try to do is to get small businesses, small companies or small shops to have an online presence. And so I've worked to train most of the young adults and the men and women who are able to do those things. And Google has a WYSIWYGI site designer that they can do. And then for those who show more interest and they get really good at Joomla, which is fairly easy for anyone to learn, irrespective of your educational level, with the help of Mr. Kellers and Mark Mickelson in Spokane, and a few people, I've been able to gather together some laptops, old laptops, which I often get from some of my clients. If they need to upgrade their laptops, I will tell them that, why don't you either sell to me or donate your old laptops? And then I will replace either the memory or the hard drive or change the motherboard, and then put it together and give it to those young people, so that almost all of them, at least in Nigeria that I know of, have a working laptop. And so it's easy for us to get, for me to get some of the jobs I get, and sort of like, almost like subcontracting. It's not really as if I get so much job, but I get enough jobs that I can easily, and it helps as well. So I get jobs and I say, okay, you design these pages, you work on these pages, you work on these pages. And for a few of them, it has assisted them, that some of them are in university. In fact, one guy who was working as a houseboy, that is like a household servant somewhere, he's going to get graduated in about a year as a pharmacist, and he's paying his tuition with some assistance we provide, and mostly by also doing jobs on campus and designing websites and doing graphic works on his computer for people. Then we also organize bead work. We train the young ladies on how to do beads for earrings and necklaces, and some of them will take it to various companies and offer to sell them. Some they will take it to supermarkets and tell them, just keep it there. When people buy, you take 20% of what we're selling it for, and you give us the balance. And that has been helping a number of them. Last year, August, I got together about 21 of the young adults from various congregations in West Africa. I think donations came from Mr. Mikkelsen's congregation and someone, I think Maurice Pebwart, donated also personally, her and team, she and her husband, and they paid for their flights to come down to Nigeria. I've been blessed to have an office that will accommodate them. I train corporate clients on various applications. And so the 26 people came together. They stayed 3 weeks. I taught the men how to use various computer applications, and the ladies were taught how to do beadworks and what we call tie and dye. You get a white piece of cloth, you tie stones into them. You use various dyes and you come out with various patterns of dresses. And that has been helping in its own way. The Children Education Fund continues to be a big help, especially in Lagos, where things are really fairly expensive, and in Owerri, where the cost of education is not expensive, but because they are mostly small-scale farmers, there are almost no mechanized farming in Nigeria except by very expensive people. Some of them might have property in ancestral lands that might be 10 acres, but they can probably only work on about what is not bigger than this place, to at least get enough to take care of themselves and their families. And so education has been a big issue there. We've worked on providing training in English language so that they can at least be able to do better in the schools we put them into. And that has borne some really nice fruits in the last 2 years. Ms. Mikkelsen got various children's books, story books, and sent them to us. We distributed it and formed children's library in all the congregations. We encouraged the parents who could speak English to try and speak to their kids in English and use some of the young adults to organize classes for them on Sundays. And it has improved our Sabbath classes anyway, as well as improved those children in the schools. But some of the parents have been encouraged to ask that we help put their kids in better schools, which we've done. So what we're trying to do is to increase the level of education of everyone from the ground up, help provide in areas where we can for those who are the older ones, the parents who have kids that they are struggling to feed. It's not uncommon in Nigeria to have families like what Mr. Kellos was saying. We call it 101 or 001. That means you miss, if it's 001, you miss breakfast, lunch, and you take dinner. And if it's 101, you take breakfast, you meet lunch, and you take dinner. I went through that with my wife sometimes. And our first son. Sometimes we'll first breakfast and lunch, we'll skip it. And then we'll have dinner. Anyway, we are thankful for the prayers of the brethren. There are a number of people who have actually also assisted in financial ways. But most importantly, we just want to thank everyone for your prayers. We want to thank you for your gifts that you often send during the feast. They do make a big difference in our feast. And our feast for the past 3 years have been really memorable ones. We enjoy feasts. It's a family event. And the cost of an accommodation per night oftentimes is about maybe $20, $30 a night. But that's about what some people pay for a month's rent in a single room. And there's no way they could afford to take that and to pay for a day. And then for meals will go for per person at a feast. The cheapest will offer, the hotels that we choose are way out of town so that the cost can be very low. And we all stay in a single place. The meals oftentimes could go as much as about $20, $30 a meal. But we will go for the cheapest we can get, and that is about maybe $4 or $5 a meal. That's why I say restaurants, businesses cannot survive much in Nigeria. Very few people, maybe companies, go to restaurants. And almost maybe less than 2% of the families in the entire congregation in Nigeria can afford to have maybe a family of four, each person spending $4 or $5 a meal and take morning, afternoon, evening. So some of them will actually come to the feast, and they will just take like bread and tea or bread and butter all day. And so in the past, I think about 3 or 4 years, some donations have been sent through Mr. Kellos and Mr. Mikkelsen, and we've been able to provide meals twice a day during the feast. So we can now go for something a little bit more nutritious and a bit richer so that we can have people having meals in the afternoon and in the evenings every day at the feast. And that has been really wonderful. It has made a difference in the enjoyment at the feast. And people are much more happy and always thankful and grateful for the opportunity God has given us to have people who really indeed they do care about not just them, but other people in various parts of Africa. Merci beaucoup.